I'm Ian Van Driel, and I'm the Associate Dean of Research Training for the Faculty of Medicine. And I'd certainly like to encourage you all to consider a career in research. I think there's never been a better time to think about biomedical research and to work in this area. Really, the tools and resources we have to understand the fundamental aspects of life are unprecedented. And certainly in the next 20-odd years will be incredibly exciting, the sort of time when you'll be developing your research careers. In addition, the ability to translate basic biomedical research into ways of helping mankind in medicine or commercialization are also fantastic. And perhaps a good illustration of that is that it now costs about $3,000 to sequence an individual human genome. So within a few years, it's going to be possible for everyday people to be able to get their own genome sequences or sequence the genomes of their children. And so the possibilities that opens up in terms of intervention in disease is going to be incredible. So that also means that the range of careers that people will be able to have if they've had some research training will also be fantastic over the next coming decades. So we've got a great panel of people here to help to explain the joys and challenges of research. But also I need to importantly remind you that there'll be pizza after this session, and that'll be served down the end of the corridor there. There's also a series of brochures which can help you find information about how to get into careers in research. And also, Dimity Evans will be floating around, who's our research high degree manager in the faculty. He'll also be able to answer any questions. She was just standing over there. There she is there. Okay, I'd now like to introduce you to Natalie Jones from the Australian Society of Medical Research.
This is a good opportunity for me to actually introduce our society and let you know some of the key things that make our society one of the peak medical organisational societies in Australia. So I've just got a couple of slides that I'm going to run through, but if you have any other questions, we have our ASMR members in the front who so kindly put up their hand to alert everyone to themselves, and we're happy to take any questions during or at the end of the session. So ASMR is a long-established society that has successfully worked towards promoting, developing and assisting the study and dissemination of knowledge and information that concerns medical health research in Australia. We reach over 140,000 Australians, and you can see that through our work we actually make a great impact in both the scientific advocacy as well as towards the political advocacy for medical research. So you may not be aware of the huge amount of work that ASMR puts in towards promoting political advocacy. And a lot of this work has gone towards building reports to encourage the government to not reduce funding available to our early career scientists, but to actually strengthen their reasons for why it's important to improve the funding and resources that are available to our early career scientists, as well as the students that are developing their own research through their honours and PhD projects. One of the things that I think is most important in our society is the scientific advocacy. And in particular, there are a few things that I've listed on the screen here. But what I want to point out is that ASMR are responsible for the Australian Health and Medical Research Congress, which this year is actually being held in Melbourne. So it's a great opportunity for PhD students and early career scientists to actually attend this event and network with research experts in their own field. So it's a fabulous opportunity in Melbourne to actually get your own profile developed, but also to network with some really important people. And this Congress brings together a huge variety of scientists, both internationally and nationally. So it's a collaboration of a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge to not just talk about the research, but maybe even how you can get a position overseas. So there are things, or there are opportunities there for you to expand your own personal career development in research. We also have professional development workshops, which work towards helping you develop leadership qualities as a researcher, but also if you're interested in starting up your own lab. There are certain things that you don't necessarily learn in your PhD, but through our professional development workshops, this provides the opportunity to have some additional training. Of interest to a lot of students is that we have ASMR Research Awards. Now, we have two awards each year. There's a $5,000 international award and a $2,000 local award. These awards are eligible to only ASMR members. So I would encourage, this would be one reason why I would encourage students who aren't ASMR members to join, because it provides the opportunity to expand your own research project in a lab outside of your own home city. And you can feel free to talk to us more about that later on in the night. One of the other things that ASMR is very well known for is our public advocacy role and promoting the awareness of medical and health research, not just to students, but also to the wider community. And we do this through our work during Medical Research Week, which this year is from June 4th to the 11th. I've listed a few of the events that are taking place during Medical Research Week, but of particular importance, I just wanted to point out that we have a Medical Research Week dinner, which is held on the 10th of June, and we have some booking forms in the foyer there if you're interested. We also we're also holding a student research symposium for honours, masters, and PhD students, and there's some details on our website for people to go to if they're interested. We're also holding a trivia night in North Melbourne, so not that far away, on the 9th of June. So if anyone's interested, we also have some flyers in the foyer that give you the details of that event. So finally, I wanted to leave with the last couple of slides to say why it's important to become an ASMR member. So the first thing is that you can go online and fill out an application form, and the details are online, or you can see one of our ASMR representatives. But essentially, the benefit of being an ASMR member is quite well-rounded, and it makes you a more sort of enabled researcher, in such that you can pay less with registration costs for ASMR events, that being conferences or professional development workshops. As I mentioned earlier on, you're eligible for travel and research awards. ASMR keep their members updated about health and medical research events that are happening around Australia. You're made aware of the policies that actually affect your career, so that you're not just a researcher idly working by the bench, working very hard, but not really aware of, you know, how funding issues might actually affect you down the track. And at the end of the day, ASMR gives their members an opportunity to have their say in the various events or various forums that ASMR are involved with. And one of the things I probably want to leave with is that as a researcher, I can clearly say that one of the most important things is actually, apart from working very hard at the bench, is actually building your own scientific profile. And I know through my work with ASMR, which only began a couple of years ago, I found that by networking with people both in the ASMR community, but also around Australia, it provides you with the opportunity to find out areas of your own research that you can further develop, but also areas of your personality that you can take further and use to develop leadership skills if you are particularly interested in having your own lab, or using your skills to transfer into other areas of research. So thank you very much. So now what I would like to do is introduce Dr. Shane Huntington, who is our MC for this evening. And I'd just like to briefly mention a few things. Shane is currently the Principal Strategy Advisor to the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, Professor Glyn Davis. In addition, he is a founder and the Managing Director of the Innovation Group, which is a Victorian-based company that was set up in 2000 to assist with the commercialisation of Victorian research and technology. What you may not know, or you may know if a lot of you listen to the radio, is that for the past 15 years, Dr. Shane Huntington has been a broadcaster on Triple R's Science radio program. And in this capacity, he's had the great pleasure of introducing over 500 scientists and talking to them about their research and their career. So he's more than capable of getting in there in the dirty with all the researchers. So Shane has a PhD in physics with a specialty in phototonics and imaging. So if anyone has an interest in that area, I'm sure Shane would be happy to talk to you in more detail about that. So thank you very much, Shane.
Over the next sort of hour or so, what I want to do is basically take you from a point where you're probably at now, where you're a little suspicious perhaps of research, and convince you that these four people are the happiest people in the room because they've done it. Now, you know, they're all smiling now, but a few seconds ago they weren't. It's because they've had a hard day. or Karen perhaps, maybe not, she's been working downtown in the luxuries of the law, you know, world, and we'll talk more about what that entails. But the other guys have been grunging away in the labs and doing stuff. So first of all, let me introduce them. Brad here, just to my right, Brad Coleman, is, he's my personal favourite, and that's only because he has a forklift licence. Okay, he's done some interesting things. He's currently doing a PhD, which he started in 2009, so he's still fresh. So his answers will be kind of upbeat. He'll still be good to go. But in his honours thesis, he has the best title, Detecting the Undetectable. I'm sure we'll learn what that means, but sounds out there. A Sensitive Prion Amplification Assay. That's the point where my brain switched off as a physics guy. Don't know what that means, but we'll talk about that in a moment. He's currently doing a PhD investigating the molecular mechanisms of intercellular transmission of prions. I could go on, but I won't. It's all very interesting research. Next thing we have Danny Hatters. Now, he's a little bit further along in his career. Danny's actually, he's travelled to places like Oxford and worked at Oxford for several months. He did postdoctoral work, so this is after you do your PhD, you spend some time working as a researcher, hopefully overseas. He did that at Gladstone Institute of Cardiovascular and Neurological Diseases in the University of California, which is in San Francisco, great city. And I'm going to read what you did there because I find this incredible, and if I can even get this out in one sentence, it'll be a minor miracle. Explored the biophysical and structural properties of the three different isoforms of... What's that word?
Apolipoprotein.
Thank you. E, that each infer substantially different risks to Alzheimer's disease. Sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means. Then, of course, we managed to get him back to the University of Melbourne, where he managed to get a Roper Fellowship and was working in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. And, of course, he's now the recipient of one of the Grimwade Fellowships and runs his own lab, investigating how different protein conformations influence cellular functioning in living systems. This stuff is gold. So he will be talking more about that. Then to the right, we have the escapee, Karen Bentley, who did her work at the McFarlane Burnet Centre for Medical Research, her honours work. She then did a PhD on bidirectional transcription from HIV-1 long terminal repeat. I'm not sure what that means. But it was enough to cure her of working in the research world, and she moved out and became a patent attorney, which is one of the areas that many of our researchers go into, regardless of whether it's medical research or other areas, and they usually find that they have a very rewarding and loving life in that world and speak highly of the rest of us. At the end of the line is Professor Sylvia Metcalf. Now, Sylvia is currently over at the Murdoch, and so it was a bit of a walk. Down from there. And Sylvia has worked in London, New York, and here in Melbourne for many years, and has focused on understanding genetics of health professionals in the community with respect to implications of the sort of new genetic technologies that are coming out and genetic screening and testing and the impact of these on diagnosis. So this is a very important area, and she's currently at part of the University of Melbourne, a group leader in the Genetics Education and Health Research Program at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, which some of you will know is attached to the Royal the Children's Hospital. And you should be getting some very nice new offices and labs soon, no doubt, if the drilling ever stops. So, as I said, what we want to do tonight is just explore a bit more about why these guys got into research, what it means to them, how it sort of influenced their lives, and why they have or have not sort of, got something positive out of it. I mean, I know some researchers who haven't, so it's not always a positive story. Often at these events, all you ever hear is a positive story. There are negative stories of research, and some people don't fit the mould quite that well. So hopefully you'll get a feel tonight as to whether you do, or at least whether it's worth exploring for you. So what I want to do is just start off with a simple question. Of why you actually did research in the first place. So, Brad, you're still fresh?
Yep. I sort of came to the end of my degree and thought, had the opportunity to do honours. Found a project that I liked with a supervisor that seemed to share similar sort of things with. And, just started honours. Thought, I'll give honours a go, see how I enjoy being in the lab, if I like it. Might do a PhD. If I hate it, go bugger off and find something else to do. And fortunately, so it's panned out, I've ended up enjoying it. So I decided to start and go ahead with a PhD. Hey,
Danny.
Look, I've always loved science. I mean, when I was a kid, I was always interested in nature and the environment. I always wanted to become a botanist and save the world. So when I was at uni, I loaded my whole degree up in botany.
Botanist that saves the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was all the greenhouse effect.
I mean, as a physicist, there was a chance I'd destroy it. Yeah.
But well, the greenhouse effect was very new back then. I thought maybe if you plant a few more trees, we could save the world. So I was always very interested, and I loaded my undergrad degree up with a lot of botany and genetics. And then when I went into honours, I really hit my element. So, I mean, this may be common to some people here, but in undergrad, you know, you're sort of bombarded with all this information. I was never very good at absorbing it. But I think once I went into honours, I realised that, you know, this is a, you know, I love problem solving, and that's really what research is about. You're solving problems, and I love that. So I did honours in botany. And then, you know, I ended up just getting a job in a biochemistry department. I never did any biochem in undergrad, so that was a real shock to the system. But look, I loved it, and it just continued on from there. PhD is a natural progression, and that's really how I got into it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Karen, you moved out of research, but before we get to that, what got you into it in the first place?
I never intended to go into it. I was always going to be a vet. So if anyone here knows, to get into vet science, you've actually got to do first year of a science degree. But in contrast to my colleague here, I hated botany, so I did a medical science undergrad degree, which didn't involve any plants whatsoever. But at the end of the first year of that, I kind of forgot about transferring over to vet. I'd enjoyed what I'd done and just sort of stayed with the undergrad with all the medical-based applications. The third year of that degree actually involves working in a lab for a year, and I actually ended up being in a lab that was semi-diagnostic but had a research component to it. And the undergraduate degree, really 90% of people that come out of it do go into diagnostic science, but this year an exposure to research meant that I then considered honours, and then from honours, as we said, the natural progression was just into a PhD. So that's how I ended up there.
And Sylvia?
Okay, I have some unusual starts because I think initially my love of science and research was through reading some science fiction. And there was a heroine in one of the John Wyndham novels who was a biochemist. So I thought, that sounds interesting. I'll read up on biochemistry. Strange at 14, very odd. And also at that time, perhaps more poignantly, my grandfather who was living with us was dying of esophageal cancer. So I decided I wanted to find a cure for cancer. And that was really what got me into research. Very personal. I didn't find a cure for cancer, but you can still keep on trying. And I actually spent a lot of time doing lab-based research, almost 20 years lab-based research, and have moved away from that. And but you can still do lots of different types of medical research. It doesn't always have to be at the bench.
How many people in the room, just a show of hands, have gotten into the sort of degree they're in because of something they watched on television or read?
Okay, I'm peculiar. Sorry.
A few. I mean, it's interesting, you know, because often science fiction in particular is just a few steps ahead of where science fact is. Now, many times it's also way off base, but it can be sort of, you know, give you an idea of where things are heading. I mean, I did my physics degree because I read the book The Time Machine. Boy, was I surprised. But, you know, hey, you know, it was the sort of stuff that inspires you. And so, you know, I know people don't tend to put their hands up whenever I ask this question, but often we are heavily, influenced by what we read. We often consider what we see on the news to be more valid or important than fiction. That's an editor telling you what to think. Often it's less valid than reading fiction about, you know, scientific principles and stories and ideas. So, you know, if you have an interest in science because of that, you're actually probably more in the majority of most scientists, in the minority of those who'll admit it, certainly, but it's actually quite common. So, guys, well, Danny, let me start with you. What's your sort of most memorable experience thus far in your career as a researcher?
Good, memorable, or bad?
You need to entertain me.
It's a tricky one. I guess, you know, one of the best parts about science is when, you know, you're working in the lab and you're trying to solve a problem, which is all fun. And I think there's a bit of a stereotype that scientists like to be burrowed away and they don't like to talk to people and so on, which I think is actually a real myth. But for me, the real thrill about it, and perhaps the real highlight, was when you publish your work. So when I first published my first paper, you know, that was amazing to feeling, because, you know, you've been working on this problem for a couple of years, and then, you know, you get it out in the literature, and once it's on the internet, you know, everyone can read it. And I think for me, that's the real thrill, is the fact that, you know, the work, you're creating new knowledge, and you can put it in the public domain so everybody can read it. And you feel like you're doing something good for society. So,
Karen?
Bad memory would be a delivery of HIV, having come from overseas. It was put on liquid nitrogen. The container, of course, liquid nitrogen had slowly been letting off more gas. The container had pressurised, and they couldn't get the lid off. So one of the Bright Spark postdocs decided to puncture it. And it exploded, including all the vials of concentrated HIV virus in the that were in the vial. So shut down the labs, evacuated. good memories.
And one day later, yeah, she was a patent attorney.
Yeah. good memories for me were actually attended ASMR conference a few years ago, and it was the first year that they'd offered that $5,000 international student award, and I was lucky enough to win that. So that was a real sort of validation of, it was towards the end of my PhD, and it was a nice recognition from my peers that the work was worthy of being awarded that prize.
Sylvie, your area in particular is one where you've seen a massive change in the way people are thinking about these particular issues. I mean, you've probably got 100 highlights, but what's really sort of taken your imagination and let you run with it over the last sort of 10 years?
Okay, I think that, you know, probably the announcement of the Human Genome Project, the public versus the private enterprise, the big bash that went on then, was probably a major thing, because I think that really opened the world of genetics and genomics to the, you know, to the mass populace, and that's clearly where what I sort of do comes in there. Mm-hmm. So from a research perspective, that is memorable. From a personal perspective, actually probably when my first PhD student got her PhD. There are lots of highlights, your own PhD, your paper, your first grant, all of those things. But it was like giving birth. So I was having my baby all over again. That first one was fantastic. I really enjoyed that.
So for the mothers out there, that's painful and messy.
Yeah.
Is that video still taping? Brad?
Well, for me, one of the standout ones would be when you sort of, you've been trying for at least the early stages of your PhD, trying to develop an experiment and get it to work, and you've been going on with it for months and months on end, nothing happening, complete failure, then all of a sudden, flick of a switch, you'll be sitting in the lab late at night, and suddenly you'll get that result, and everything will, just that perfect textbook result, and you're sitting there swearing and absolute joy at the top of your voice running down the lab, and everybody sort of look at you going, oh yeah, know that feeling. But yeah, that would definitely be one of the standout ones.
I can't believe you didn't say detecting the undetectable.
Oh, well.
Yeah, but that's, you know, tell us about that. Well, I mean, what
a lot of that, you know, is sort of being able to stem from being able to detect the undetectable.
Yeah.
Look, the title is a real marketing ploy.
Yeah.
To sell that thesis off to the examiners more than anything. But it was, you know, it was sort of, the lab I'm in works on prion diseases, which are sort of the generic name given to like the diseases that cause mad cow disease and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
Hold that thought, because we're about to do something where I'll give you the chance to do that, but you can't cheat. So,
okay.
You guys have heard a few scientists give talks in the past. Hands up. Do they always stick to time? do they know what time is about? Like, I find that whenever I get a scientist to give a 30-second spool on their work, it takes about 15 minutes. So at previous events of this type, I managed to grab something that my 2-year-old son stole from Safeway. hey, you got to teach them young, you know. But basically, this little cube, which has something called a gyroscope in it, which I could explain to you, but I won't because it will get you all running from the room, has a little countdown timer on it. And so we're going to hand this across, and each of them is going to give a little spool on their research for you in language that they can understand.
understand or
like well, that. Actually, that I can understand for a start, but no, preferably something. Well, where are we? Third year, fourth year? Hands up, third year, fourth year, 15th year. Not sure about career. Yep. So, just give them an idea of the sort of stuff you're working on and why it's important. And it will do that when you run out of time. So, are you ready, Brad?
No.
Go.
Okay. So yeah. So as I started off saying.
See, he's cheating already. You got to hold this thing in. It's got to stay green, pal. Go for it.
All right. So yeah, I work on prion diseases. And anyway,
You're good.
And yeah, so during my honours, I was looking at developing an assay that could detect extremely low levels of prion disease. The problem being, unlike all the nifty tools we have for sort of viral and bacterial diagnostics, we don't have anything to detect prion disease. And sort of the pathogenic agent. Wow.
It's quick, isn't it?
30 seconds is really...
30 seconds goes pretty fast.
Anyway, so yeah, basically developing an assay.
How do I start it?
So now all you do here, you give this thing a turn, it'll change colour, and when it changes back to green, you're good to go.
Okay.
It's a real test.
So I work on a really nasty disease called Huntington's disease, which is a disease that causes neurodegeneration. So it's caused by a faulty gene, and I study how the gene product, which is a protein, you should know this, sticks together and causes toxicity to cells, which is currently not very well understood. If we can work that out, we can perhaps find a cure for the disease.
Just soak up the joy of your last 8 seconds.
So any questions, anyone? Yeah.
Karen, tell us what... Now, you're in a different world. You're in the law firm now as a patent attorney. What do you do?
Also, I don't get to talk about my PhD.
You can talk about your research as well if you like.
I can probably do that in 30 seconds, so I'll do the PhD.
All right.
So I was looking at HIV, and what they found was that as well as replicating and copying itself in a forwards direction, it also copied itself to some extent in a reverse direction. So it produced this transcript. Nobody knew what it did, nobody knew why it did it, so I was looking at characterising that, what controlled the expression of it, and potentially, of course, anything new with HIV could be a target for therapy.
Very good.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Sylvia?
So you want me to turn this way?
And go again.
So essentially, I can't get this right.
It's quite a child's sort of toy, isn't it?
Bright green?
It's hard.
That one?
Again?
Again. That way.
And one more?
Blue.
Keep going. Good to go.
Essentially, I'm looking at the ethical and social implications of genetic testing and genetic technologies, and particularly in the community, how they understand what that means to them, implications for family members, how they make informed decisions about whether to be tested or not. So much more sort of social, but still underpinned by lots of understanding of genetics and what that actually means.
Very good.
Did it beep?
No. Time to spare. Mm-hmm. See, I find this very instructive with these people because it is hard to do actually, and if you're not used to it, Anyway. Now, what I want you guys to be thinking about now is some of the questions you might have for the group. We're not going to ask them right now, but at the end, you'll have an opportunity to ask a number of questions. And I know there is a certain strict requirement placed by the ASMR on the number of questions asked before the pizza is served. So, you know, start thinking about the sort of things you would want to ask them. They're a friendly bunch, and they will tell you it straight. That's part of the point of the evening, not to give you a brochure for an hour, but to give you a straight answer on what the careers are like. And, you know, indicating, like, Karen and myself have both left our research careers for very good reasons, and are very happy doing it. But, Karen, I might just get you to sort of speak to the value of your PhD in research to your current career.
Okay. Look, as a minimum, I'm a patent attorney in the biotech area, and it's super, super competitive. So as an absolute minimum requirement for a law firm to even look at you, you have to have a PhD. The PhD, though, it teaches you a certain way of thinking and a certain way of looking at problems. And I see that because the other way that you can get into being a patent attorney is if you do a science law degree. So sometimes some of the other patent attorneys in our group maybe have law with just honours for their science. And they, I think, readily admit that they struggle a little bit compared to those of us with that further education with a PhD and a postdoc position. To sort of think maybe as laterally and as broadly, you get a lot more exposure as well, having been in that research environment for those 3, 4, 5, 6 years, however long it takes you to knock off your PhD. And that's really important in the work that we do actually do day to day, because people bring us their invention and say, I need to protect this legally. So the scientists are very focused on their project and what their scientific invention is. My job is to make sure that I understand it, and I understand it to an extent that I can think about how the competitor is going to design around it to avoid infringing their patent. So I need to have that sort of lateral thinking that I can think big picture when the scientist brings me the smaller picture. And I think that comes from the problem solving that you have to put into your own PhDs and research careers, because things don't work and you can't always just look up a paper to find out what the answer is.
Danny, you run an entire laboratory. So that's a lot of management, a lot of financial sort of requirements. There's a whole lot more than just research. Where did you get those skills, and how did doing a research sort of PhD or sort of your honours work sort of lead into that? How did that help you do your current job?
Good question. So, I mean, I think it's like everything. I mean, every step in your career, there's always a new learning curve. And, you know, you might think that you get to the end of your undergrad, you've done all the hard yards. Well, going to honours is another whole level, and then going to a PhD is another level. Doing a postdoc is another level, and then running a lab is really hard, actually. I mean, there's a lot of things you have to learn, like learning how to manage people and learning how to manage money, and I'm really bad at that. So, I mean, I was a little bit lucky because when I was working in the US, they had a really good postdoctoral organisation there where they taught a lot of things about management and interpersonal skills, not so much about budgeting, but other skills such as grant writing. And I think it is very difficult, and I think the important thing is to have mentors or people you can talk to, people who are more senior than you, who've been through what you've been through, and then they can give you personal advice on how things work. And this is especially important, I think, for things like grant writing, because grant writing is very difficult, and it requires a whole new skill set which you won't have gotten from just doing basic lab research or writing manuscripts. So I think the key is just to network, communicate with people, be open with people and ask for advice all the time, and not to be insular and closed. I think that is a killer in science. You have to get out and network and talk to people. And I think if you can do that, you'll probably be okay.
How many people in the room are considering a PhD quite seriously? How many people in the room were considering before we started? Okay, it's going up. You guys are doing good. Sylvia, let me ask you the same sort of question. What skills did you learn during your PhD years that you bring to bear now in your quite senior role over at the Murdoch?
In my PhD years? Mm-hmm. Probably not as much as I would have liked. I was in a reasonably small institute in a small group. I think as I've gone into other institutes and larger groups, it's been giving me better opportunities to network. Absolutely agree with what you say, networking is critical. So I think PhD students these days have many more opportunities to have mentors and to be part of something like the ASMR to give you a lot of, you know, to be exposed to a lot of those skills. Certainly problem solving was something I did learn. It was fantastic. In fact, actually, my PhD was the best lab-based research time for me. It beat my postdocs hands down. So maybe that was just because I was passionate about what I was doing. I really enjoyed what I was doing. I'm not sure I did that with all subsequent research areas. And I had a terrific supervisor who was there for me all the time.
Brad, what are you learning in your PhD?
Oh, look. The list goes on and on, I think.
I guess, let me put it another way. What are you learning in your PhD that you sort of don't feel you'd learn elsewhere?
Well, I don't really know what elsewhere is.
Well, you know, if you...
no, look,
if you'd left after your undergrad and just gone and been a forklift driver, not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, he's working on some pretty tough stuff now. I mean, what sort of skills are you getting?
Oh, look, I've got everything from, sort of technical skills, sort of your own writing, presentation, all that sort of stuff that you probably hear, you know, given spieled on to you guys in different marketing things. Sort of people skills are becoming a really big thing, the networking. Look, it's just, there's a lot there. Managing, a lot of it is, I think, managing yourself under quite intense pressure and being able to sort of control that. I don't know.
Can you tell us a bit how, I mean, a lot of the audience are in undergraduate years currently. How does your sort of PhD day differ to what it was like when you were an undergrad?
Well, undergrad was always very sort of fixed. I mean, it's like you go to this lecture at this point in time. And that's sort of basically how undergrad went. Whether or not you went to that lecture was a whole different story, I think. But with a PhD, you're given a lot more sort of, or at least I have been given a lot more independence in sort of how I structure my day. If sort of my supervisor is very hands-off, he'll give you a lot of sort of guidance at the required time, but, you know, you're left to your own devices. You've basically got to sort of identify whatever the problem is that you need to address, and then how to sort of formulate a method to solve that problem. So, you know, if you don't perform on that and you see him at some point in time, he'll certainly rap you over the ears about it. But you're not being babied or anything like that, and it is, your day is fairly flexible with what you do with it, so it's quite good in some regards like that, and to others I think it's a bit tougher. So personally I love it because I could sort of rock up whenever I want and leave whenever I want, but no.
Sylvia, what sort of things do you look for when you take on a PhD student?
So someone who is really enthusiastic. You know, you have to really want to do that project. You want to be there. So someone who shows that spark when I talk to them. You know, good marks is always something we need. Primarily for scholarships, it's more important in order to get the scholarship. Sometimes, though, we have students who clearly, in my case, who may have done pretty well at the in science subjects, but who chooses not to continue doing lab work at honours or a PhD, but might have done honours in the lab. So flexibility, good writing skills, being able to communicate, being able to get on well. I have a very tight team, and if you don't get on well in my group, it will show. Yeah.
Danny, when a person turns up day one for a PhD, what do they expect to happen to them? How does it start? Like, how do they get going? Mm-hmm. Don't just suddenly start writing papers, obviously.
No. Look, I mean, it might sound really scary doing a PhD. And, you know, and Brad mentioned that he does sort of have a lot of independence, and that's true. But the thing to remember is that, you know, for example, if I have a new student starting, I mean, they'll come in and it'll be like starting a new job. I mean, you're not thrown to the wolves. I mean, we can't expect you to sort of, you know, swim in a raging torrent. So what we do is we usually have somebody in the lab who can sort of guide you around, help you get settled. You'll have your own desk, you'll have your own lab bench, and you know, you'll come along to the lab meetings, you'll be part of the team, you'll be made to feel welcome. I mean, often we'll take people out for lunch, but certainly, you know, it's all about learning and being willing to learn. So, you know, we don't expect people to come in and know how to do everything. I mean, that's the whole point of a PhD. You're learning new skills. So there'll be technical skills in the lab, people in the lab who can help you learn the new techniques. My role as a supervisor will be to sit down and help structure the project for the student, help guide them in the right direction, point them in the right way. But on the same token, I don't like to have to micromanage people either. So, you know, I don't want to have to come in and say, okay, you do this experiment now, and then, you know, in 1 hour you can do that experiment. So I think at the PhD level, there's an expectation that you should be able to at least plan the experiments that you need to do. And I really like to encourage students to ask questions. You know, people don't know everything, and I'd really prefer people to say, look, Danny, I've got no idea what I'm doing. Can you please sit down with me and talk about it? I'm happy to talk for hours with people if they're really engaged and enthusiastic. It's like what Sylvia was saying. You know, I want students who are engaged and who are enthusiastic. If you're not enthusiastic, if you come in and you're really sort of a bit distant, I'm not going to like that. And I can tell from when I meet people, I can get a sense of that. So I like to see people who are enthusiastic, and I think that's the key. It's like working a new job. And after a few weeks, you'll find your feet, and then it's almost like a job, you know. Yeah.
It's interesting, the comments about enthusiasm, because I know every Sunday when I do my radio broadcast on 3RRR, I get a variety of sorts of researchers coming in. And there are those that I would consider to be sort of average in a way, and they come in and it's clearly a Sunday morning for them. They're not very enthusiastic about what they do. They're not enthusiastic on air, and they last about 4 minutes and I kick them out. Then there's the people that, you know, our panel's talking about, that just seem to have a generic love for finding out things, for doing the research. You know, there's highs and lows, times you want to quit, times you can't wait to get back in the lab. But they come into us on a Sunday morning and they're just inspirational to listen to. I mean, you know, as a physics person, you know, hearing stories from medical researchers that make me want to know more is quite something. You know, these stories often are things I don't know anything about, but, you know, they get you going. And I know Brad's supervisor was interviewed by me about 3 or 4 weeks ago about prion diseases, and this was an area where I knew nothing about it. It's a relatively new field. You know, 20, 30 years ago, it was kind of unknown.
Yeah.
And it sort of just inspired our audience to sort of call up and just want to know more. And that was all in the space of about 8 minutes. So you get that sense of enthusiasm from certain researchers, and they're the ones that, as students, you should look for as supervisors, because you don't want to work on people who bore you the day that they meet you, because that will continue and it's infectious. Now, Karen, I want to ask you, you left, so you obviously didn't feel the fit was right for you. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, what went wrong or what didn't you like?
Okay, well, my PhD was, you know, they say it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. I wasn't sure, probably about 2 years into the PhD, if it was really what I wanted to be doing with the rest of my life. But if you start something, you finish it, so I did. I then got to the end of my PhD and thought, well, is it the project, is it the lab, is it the institute, should I give it a go? I've already put this much time into it. So I actually went to the Murdoch and did a postdoc for 3 years. Changed fields, so I changed institutes and said, no, this still doesn't really suit me. But I loved the day-to-day science. I loved the basis of science. It was just the... Look, being in a lab doing research, it's tough. It's demanding hours. You know, until you've done a time course experiment where you have to take a sample every 3 hours and that goes for 24 hours, you know, you really don't realise how tough it can be. It's tough funding-wise. You know, you need to be producing papers. Your papers then get you the grants. The grants then pay for you to continue your research. And that's a really tough cycle if you can't actually get onto that grant cycle and get a project that's working well and getting publications for you. So that's when I started looking for something outside of science that kept me in the science per se and utilised all the skills that I'd learnt during my science career and my PhD and postdoc. And that's when I ended up as a patent attorney.
Show of hands if money's important to you. Oh, come on.
You are so in the wrong careers.
Hands up if you think doing a research career in medical research will put you behind the eight ball in financially. A few? Okay.
Where
are
all the RAs, by the way?
Oh, you're the RAs. Well, sorry to hear that. But there's hope for you if you enrol in a PhD. Now this is interesting because, I mean, the guys here, I'm curious as to what, well, maybe we'll leave Brad alone for a moment because he's getting his beautiful scholarship tax-free. But guys, how have you found the sort of remuneration as a result of research, including you, Karen? I mean, personally, if you have a hint of entrepreneurial brain in there somewhere, research can make you a lot of money. And if you have no entrepreneurial skills at all, I think you're very comfortable doing research. Now, Brett? Sorry, Danny?
Look, I mean, it's a funny thing for me. I mean, I was always worried about the money, especially when you're a student, because you're so desperately poor. And I was so poor as an undergraduate. I mean, I was, you know, I could hardly even buy food. I was that poor. And then, you know, when you do a PhD, it's a little bit better because you get a scholarship, but it's pretty lousy, I mean, really. So, you know, I was always worried about the money, and I have to say, maybe it's beaten me down a bit, I don't know. But my salary now is not too bad, and I'm quite happy with it. You know, I've bought a house, I'm quite comfortable. And, you know, and I don't have any grand aspirations to be a millionaire or anything, but I think if, you know, perhaps there are many other opportunities where you could make a lot more money. But I do think Shane has a really good point. I mean, I was fortunate enough to work in San Francisco, which is the heart, one of the innovation hubs of the world. And there, everyone's very entrepreneurial. Everyone there is out to make money. And there are a lot of researchers. Well, there's a couple of things. There's a lot of researchers who like to invent things and form their own companies. And if you have that sort of spirit, I agree. You know, intellectual property can make you a lot of money if you hit something big. But also, you know, when you do a PhD and go on to do a postdoc, that's a really rich recruiting ground for companies who are looking for scientists. And I think if you enter a company, a biotech company at a postdoc level, then it puts you in a really good position to become like a senior person in that company. And you can earn a lot of money that way. And I have to say, after living in California, most postdocs, because it's very hard to get academic jobs, most postdocs went into the biotech world, and I still have some good friends in the biotech world, and they love it. I mean, I don't think biotech's for me. It's just not what I like to do, I don't think. But my friends absolutely love it, and they're probably earning three times as much money as me. So, you know, so there is something to be said about that. But I think, you know, the important thing is, as you get older, for me, money is less important. I'd rather just enjoy my job, have a good family life, you know, do something that's for the benefit of people. But maybe I'm just naive and stupid. I don't know. So.
An honest answer. Karen?
I don't think anyone goes into science for the money. You go into science because you love it. If you want to do money, go into law, go into medicine or something, you know. Look, I came out of my PhD and my first postdoc income. So, well, to put it all in context, 4 years undergrad, 1 year honours, 4 years PhD. So I had 9 years of tertiary education, and I came out earning less than my husband, who'd done a four-year engineering degree. But again, I did it because I loved it. The fact that I've now gone into law, the money is just a bonus. You do get used to the higher income, I must admit. So as Danny was saying, there are opportunities, if the money side is really important to you, to develop a career path that still involves your science and does get you the financial remuneration that you're looking for.
So I agree with everything you say. I think that the research salaries in academia are comfortable, certainly well enough, you know, good enough to buy houses, to, you know, have a nice car and so on. You will earn more if you do some of the other things like biotech. Not as many opportunities for biotech in Australia, but they're there. And if you are entrepreneurial, then there are opportunities. I'm actually employed by the University of Melbourne. I'm one of the lucky people who has a continuing appointment. So I would say it's not so much the level of remuneration that is a consideration. It's what we call soft money in academic research. In other words, you might only get grants that cover you for 3 years or 5 years. It's a continuing cycle. For some people, that is problematic. You've got to maintain a high level of production. That's the downside. But there are ways of working through that. If you work in labs that constantly get grants, there's always enough to keep you ticking over. If you work in a small group where it's really just one grant coming in and that's your salary and you don't get it for a year, who's going to pick up that? So I think that's one of the downsides of academic research. We need to talk about it. People need to know it exists. I hope it's something that's going to improve. But to be quite frank, what do other people think? I don't know whether it ever will.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree, and maybe I should have mentioned that. The soft money is a real issue. I mean, certainly from my perspective, you know, when I went to the US, I was kind of lucky. I went to a wealthy institute. They could afford to keep me going as long as I wanted. But again, you know, you can't be a total, you know, slacker or anything like that. But, you know, coming back to Australia, it's actually difficult because, you know, when you're coming back after your postdoc, there's not that many opportunities, really. You have to get some kind of fellowship. A lot of them are very competitive and difficult to get. They're often only 3 years. So, you know, you just get a fellowship and then almost instantly you've got to start thinking about where your next salary is going to come from. So that's a real problem. And I think it's very, very, very competitive in Australia. So I think it's a downside. And I think you have to work very hard and very smart, and you can't afford to lose your productivity in science, because it can hurt you a lot, I think. But on the same token, I mean, I don't want to discourage you from science because I love what I do and I think it's brilliant. And I'm surviving. I mean, I've got grants and I've got fellowships. So you can do it, but it isn't easy, I don't think.
Stuff. In fact, there's actually only one pizza. Yeah. We can only afford one. The ASMR have really gone down on the pizza. I'm told there's a pizza for everyone. It's interesting that the financial issues, though, are something that people often don't talk about. And I've been at events where people have put up starting salaries of $40,000 for various science fields. If you end up in, for example, forensic medicine or forensic science out at McLeod, you know, they have a really low pay relative to the crap they have to put up with, frankly. It's not always glamour. But I think one of the things that I found in particular with medical research and healthcare and all of those industries around biotech is relative to the other sciences and certainly the areas that I came from, the physical sciences, it's a really good place to be. And the reason for that is simple. It's a growth industry. If you look at physics and mathematics and many of the other fields that you could possibly go into, these areas aren't exploding in quite the same way as medical research. I mean, at the moment, there is so much stuff going on in medical research. It's phenomenal. You look back 20 years ago and just have a look in the newsreels about things that we didn't know about then that we're now working on today in just the space of 2 decades. I can tell you, in the physics community, that sort of stuff, you know, we had Newton, we had Einstein, that's about it. Not much has happened. But that's not completely true, but of course, you know, in medical research, it is just an explosion every other year. It's quite incredible. And with that comes jobs and opportunities. And it is tough in the Australian context because, unfortunately, in Australia, about 0.5% of our GDP is spent on research in this country, whereas in Europe and the US, it's 3%. So we're a bit behind the eight ball. But there are good opportunities, and within a kilometre of where we are right now, there are spectacular opportunities like nowhere else pretty much in the country. And in fact, this location and the one at Monash are in the two basic locations in the top 10 in the world in terms of medical research. So if you're going to do a career in research anywhere, you are in the right city to do it. Like, you can't get any better than Melbourne, with the exception of London and Boston. But, you know, 2 out of 10 of the best locations is pretty good, right? What I want to do now, I have a few more questions that I can ask the guys, but I want to kind of throw it open to you to ask them anything you like. They're being very honest. Not everything's positive, and, you know, we don't want to give you a sort of gloss over what research is about, because that just sort of leads to some people being disappointed once they're in it. But if you have some particular questions you would like to ask the guys, any or all of them, now's your opportunity. We have a fair bit of time. So, hands up. Anybody? Yeah.
Karen, how much retraining was involved with moving out of research and into, like, the patent attorney sort of field?
Right, so just to repeat the question, how much retraining was involved, Karen, when you moved into the patent attorney field?
Yep, so you have to do an additional 9 subjects to qualify as a patent attorney. I actually did my qualification through Melbourne Uni. It's a master's degree in intellectual property law. I think I was saying to some of the people earlier, I was so sick of studying, I packed that all into 2 years. So you can do it quickly. On average, you do those subjects over about a 4-year period.
So you get opportunities to speak at conferences. In the early days, you might just be submitting abstracts and then be given an oral presentation. As you go through your career, you'll be invited to these conferences. You get asked to go on television programs. You might get asked to go on radio stations. You get asked to talk here. Lots of opportunities. So being able to communicate well verbally as well as written is really an important skill to have.
Dan?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Sylvia says. In fact, I think communication is an absolutely critical skill in science. And it's one of the things that you will learn in your PhD, because you'll get chances to speak to a whole forum of people, you know, through seminars, conferences. And I'm actually involved in a number of organisations that are designed specifically for PhD students to actually get up and present their work to other students as almost like a practice forum for when, you know, for honing in their communication skills. So I think conferences is a great way to talk. Seminars at universities is another way. And I agree, you get to travel in some really nice locations because conferences are often in really good locations. So, like last year, I was in Aspen. That was pretty fun.
I was in Honolulu in November.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I just got a text message about 2 hours ago from my postdoc who's still in physics, who said he's in a bar in Santa Barbara. Yeah. I'm not sure why he's telling his supervisor that. But, you know, you want people to be happy. As long as he's working hard during the day, I don't care what he does at night. When you mentioned some of the locations you've gone to. Brad, have you had an opportunity as yet, still fresh into the PhD, to travel?
Yeah, not outside of Australia yet. We've been up to Port Douglas at the end of last year for a conference, which was pretty tough stuff. off to Japan the end of July for another conference, and then I think that's pretty much it for work-related travel this year. But
Danny's point about communication is one that's that can't be overstated. I had a PhD student about four or five years ago now, who'd come from Ghana in West Africa. His English vocabulary was about 30 words when he arrived, and his CV that was sent over was a little bit, shall we say, inflated that a little bit, so we thought he was very fluent in English. During the period of his PhD, he went from being someone who would read the text off his overheads, which for me, as someone who trains in communication, that is a golden rule that is being broken there, to someone who would just get up with nothing by the end of his PhD and give a presentation to 300 people at Stanford, which I saw. Now, he was not a particularly brilliant guy. He was just someone who had a passion to get his family from what was a pretty awful situation to this country, and he worked really hard. But his communication skills as a result of being embedded in the research community just skyrocketed. And that's something that, you know, we see on my radio program when young students are coming in and you interview them over a series of several years and you see them transform as they go through. And it's something that I always said, that you can be a half-baked researcher in terms of skill in research and be a great communicator and get a long way. Because when people are reading your journal papers and your grants and all of these things, it really does depend on how well you can communicate it. And it's not just about communicating to your peers, because when you put in grant applications, they're often read by non-experts in your field as well. So you have to be able to communicate to a broader audience. Unfortunately, what we see when we watch television is a scenario where the media sort of compartmentalise the research that we give them. And so it has to be either scary or super amazing or outrageously bad, you know, or unethical. And so when you look over the newsreels for the last 30 years, we've cured cancer about 5,000 times. And we know that's not the case, but it's interesting. If you ever want to have a feel for how this is done, record channels 7, 9 and 10 on a night when some science is on there, and have a look how formulaic the three presentations are. They're almost identical. There'll be 30 images, 10 seconds with one of these guys, someone giving you a whole lot of other crap that means nothing, and off you go back to the main presenter, the anchor. And it's formulaic, and it doesn't tell the story, which is why, you know, as with your question, it's so important that these guys get out there and tell that story elsewhere. Other questions? Yeah?
As far as the pathway into medical research goes, how would you compare doing medicine and going into research through a graduate medicine course versus the pathways that you went through?
So the question is, how would you... I'm repeating the questions, guys, just so it comes out on the audio for people who view this later. How would you compare the graduate medicine pathway that we currently have compared to the one you did before? Sylvie?
Yeah. So before the new graduate medicine course is about, because it's about to start next year, medical students would do an AMS year, so it's a one-year research year. That may be lab-based, it may not be lab-based. So there were opportunities for them to do research. However, I have to say from experience, a lot of students did see that as a bit of an easy option and perhaps didn't embrace that research component as they could have done.
I think that if you're doing the straight science pathway, honours, PhD, you will pick up more research skills by the time you finish your PhD at that point. If you go into medicine, whether it's the undergraduate or the graduate, in the new graduate MD, there will be a research component too. But I think that, you know, once you've finished your medical degree, you're going to be an intern, you're going to go through your postgraduate years one and two to train. You will come out at that, by the time you decide to specialise, with less research skills. So a lot of people with medical degrees then go on to do research after that. And in fact, if you're working in a tertiary hospital, there's almost an expectation that you do research. But I'm not convinced that they've had as much research training as if you've gone through a straight science degree, honours, PhD pathway.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
I agree with Sylvia. I think, you know, when I was working in the US, there were a lot of MD trained scientists there, and you know, coming through the medicine path. And I agree that I think, you know, PhD scientists, and perhaps it's a little controversial, are often better trained fundamentally in science. But on the same token, I think there's a real importance for people to come through the MD path as well, because there's a lot of clinical research that requires MD trained scientists to actually conduct the experiments. So I think there's a role for coming in both different directions. But I think if you're purely interested in research and you want to do sort of molecular research, then coming through the PhD pathway is probably the most direct pathway to get there.
Yeah.
You've been talking about honours, PhD path. Where does a master fit in, or does it not fit in at all?
Okay, so the question is, where does the master's fit in relative to honours and PhD? Dan, do you want to take this one?
It's a difficult question. Look, I think the default option is you go through honours and PhD. I know with the new Melbourne model, the master's is changing. I'm not exactly sure within our faculty where the master's sits at the moment, so I don't want to comment too much on it. But I think, you know, that if you really are interested in going into research, going through the honours PhD is definitely the classical way of doing it. You can go through the master's way if you want, but I think master's is designed more for not the research pathway. But I'm just saying that off the top of my head, and I don't want to say something that's not what university policy is or whatever. So,
you probably all know the Melbourne model is, you know, the undergraduate, the 2 years masters, and then maybe going on to a PhD. And the 2 years masters can be, some are much more coursework focused, really vocational, to then go on to work afterwards, and others do have a research component. I'm part of the Faculty of Medicine. We still have honours, and I still think that there is a role for honours, definitely. Doing a 2 years master's will give you some other subjects and some other skills that you might not get in your honours year. And I think that one of the things we're thinking about in the Department of Paediatrics is actually running them both in parallel, having honours and then maybe also establishing a 2 year master's. Because in that 2 years master's, you might pick up some other things, such as subjects on, how to manage your finances and various other skills. So look, I really think it's what suits you at the end of the day. I don't think we should be forcing one route over the other one. It's really what suits you.
I guess, I mean, on top of that is the fact that the Melbourne model, as it's been nicely encapsulated by The Age, that's where the name came from, is an evolutionary process. It's something that is being done over essentially 10 years. And we're about halfway through at the moment, and these things are changing as we go. So what we're trying to do across the campus is optimise it for various areas. And medicine has some unique requirements, so it makes it a little bit harder to get it exactly right. But, you know, lo and behold, the best outcome will be the one that we sort of go with for medicine, because you often don't hear much about the medical faculty at Melbourne University, but it is the powerhouse of research in the Parkville precinct. So how it goes about teaching, whether it's straight research or MDs or other, is very important. So other questions? Okay, so the question is, how does being a scientist and perhaps the stereotype of a scientist impact your private lives, and do you spend your weekends reading other people's PhDs?
Absolutely not. Have you ever seen a PhD thesis? It's about that thick, and it's the last thing I'd be doing on a Saturday. The supervisors, on the other hand, might have that to come to the time.
It's a good question. I mean, I think from my perspective, it's changed a bit over time. I think when I was doing my PhD, certainly it didn't affect my personal life at all. I mean, because the thing is, if you manage your time very effectively, you shouldn't really have to work like a dog, I don't think. I think, you know, the key is being efficient. And in science, if you're efficient, you're going to do better anyway. That's just it's probably true of any job. But I think, you know, I've found now that I'm running my own lab, I'm perhaps a lot more passionate about what I do, perhaps, and I've got more of a vested interest. And I'm actually quite happy to spend more time if I need to. So there are sometimes periods where I do have to spend extra hours to get things done. But I don't mind doing it, actually, now. So, I mean, I know that sounds really strange. But certainly, like, most of my weekends are free. I mean, I do my own stuff on the weekends. So I think it's how well you can manage your time. And I think time management's an important skill in science. It shouldn't have to take over your life. I suspect if it has taken over your life, in some cases anyway, it might mean that you're struggling anyway, because it shouldn't have to, I don't think.
So I guess from my point of view, when I was younger, more junior, I certainly was able to mix it up a lot more than I currently have. Partly it's because at the moment, I mean, I have a teaching research position. So some of you know, because some of you, I recognise some of your faces, I'm teaching you at the moment. And that can take up a lot of time. I also have a lot of PhD students at the moment. I need to get them out. So I'm actually reading 3 PhD theses at the moment as we speak. So that is taking up a lot of my time. But I do try not to let it impact on my weekends, I have to say. I'll put in the longer hours in the week. If possible, I try not to go into work at the weekends. But I need to learn to say no.
Mm. Karen, what sort of took over your life more, being in the patent attorneys of the world or being in the research world?
Research, I have a far better work-life balance now. My PhD experience seems to be a little different from these guys. Mm-hmm. I was in the lab a lot. I actually trained my husband to be my research assistant, so he could actually spend time with me in the lab on the weekend, otherwise I'd never seen. So he learnt to freeze-thaw and centrifuge. Probably completely against health and safety, but I also worked part-time. You know, the scholarship, they're good, and I think they're a lot better than they used to be. But I also worked at Meyer, so I used to work Thursday nights, Friday nights, Saturdays and Sundays. So that meant going straight from the lab straight to Meyer. Saturdays on my way home, I would actually go into the lab and do something. It can depend on the type of research project you've got. Friends of mine who are chemists, they could leave their things sitting on the bench overnight. My things were cells. They didn't stop multiplying and dividing on the weekend because it was the weekend. So it can depend on the area of research that you're in. I had to go in, even if it was for 5 minutes, to tip some media off and give them some fresh media. So I think that there is an impact in that regard, but to put it in context, it's 3 or 4 years, it sounds a lot, but it really is only a short period of your life. Yeah, it was partially that. To be honest, I now live rural. I live out near Mount Macedon now. I couldn't be as a bench scientist now and living out there because it's an hour and 10 trip into the city, and I wouldn't go into the city, you know, assuming I'm based in the city for a research career. I wouldn't go in to do a 10-minute split the cells sort of thing. So that was a decision I made, that I chose to have a slightly different outside of work interests. So it was part of it.
I can't wait to get home and tell my wife that someone managed to train their partner.
And he was really, really good for an engineer.
I think there'd be a couple of choice words if I try and do that. It won't go down well. We had another question in the front.
I just wanted to ask, do you have any advice for an undergrad student who chooses their honours project?
So the question was, is there any advice for undergraduate students choosing their honours projects? Danny?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the key... couple of golden rules. Firstly, if you find projects that sound interesting, definitely talk to the supervisor. So don't choose a form without talking to the potential supervisor, because it's important that you talk to them and find out, you know, whether you think you're going to get along with them. Because, you know, you're going to be working in a very close-knit team with these this lab. So it's worth at least seeing whether you feel like there's a compatibility there. The other thing you can also do, and I do this when I have students come to talk to me, is get the student to talk to other people in the lab, because, you know, you're working as a team and you want everyone to get along, and sometimes, you know, there's just personalities that might not quite fit or whatever, and it's important to establish that, I think. But I think that, you know, it's like what Shane was saying earlier, that you want to have a supervisor who's enthusiastic as well. So, you know, you want them to be passionate about the science, because I think it's a little bit infectious. You know, if you've got a supervisor who loves what they're doing, it's easier for you to love what you're doing in your honours project. So so I think they're the key things. And find out whether people in the lab are happy, whether PhD students are happy. And you can do that if you have a lab tour. So I think it doesn't hurt to say to the supervisor, look, can I talk to some people in your lab? I mean, I wouldn't be offended if you asked me that. So I think, you know, that's the key. You will be working very closely, and I think you want to make sure you get along with people in the lab.
In fact, many researchers end up doing their PhD with the same group and supervisor that they do their honours with. And so you are really making a choice about, you know, 1 to 4 or 5 years of your life. So you have to be somewhat demanding when you go in. It's, you know, it's bigger than buying a car. It's, you know, it is a really big deal. And if there's something that feels a bit out of whack, or you get the impression from the other people in the lab that the supervisor really doesn't have time for them, and that sort of negative feeling, it's not a good scenario to get yourself into. My PhD supervisor used to refer to it as a marriage. I actually think it wasn't like that at all, because, you know, marriage gives you a good opportunity to divorce if it's really bad. Whereas, you know, once you're in a PhD, you tend to stick with it. And I mean, I'm not sure about you guys. For me, my count was three. Three times I seriously thought about quitting. And, you know, it's not easy. It's hard. Now, fortunately for me, I was in a lab that was very supportive. Everyone went through those same highs and lows in the lab, and we all carried each other through. And so if you can find a sort of environment like that that's very positive, then that can mean a lot. And sometimes projects, be careful you don't get lured in by sexy projects that don't have much behind them. I mean, you know, it may be a buzzword that you hear, nanotechnology or something, you know, and it's not necessarily the way to make the choice. You know, choose the people and the lab and the supervisor first. If they are a great group, they'll often have great projects that on the surface may not always seem that interesting, but once you sort of dig a bit, you'll find them to be, you know, quite valuable. And try and work out what other students have managed to achieve in their time there. So if you have a scenario where you go in and they've never been to an international conference, they've never published a paper, they've been there for 4 years, I would run elsewhere, because that is just not good enough for any of the medical research institutes or the university in this area. You need to be demanding as to what you get. Other questions? Yep, then back.
Someone is currently doing their honours that undecided about a PhD, is there any, that you may like to do research, is there any option to go into research without a PhD, or is it just so competitive these days that you really, that's your only realistic sort of way in to the industry?
So the question is there an option to go into research without a PhD having just done honours? Sylvia?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we highly value our research assistants who don't have PhDs. In fact, you know, we often can't function without them. So that doing a PhD is not the be-all and end-all. I will say in Australia that the career structure for research assistants is not fantastic. You do hit a ceiling pretty early on, and often that's one of the reasons why research assistants, after a few years, will decide to do a PhD, because it does open more doors for them. Doing a PhD opens more doors for other things too, not just research. You learn a lot in your PhD, you do learn problem solving. Those are you become highly regarded. You can go into almost anything else you want to do with a PhD. A bit tougher with just honours. When I was going through university, and if I tell you how long ago that was, you'll be worried. Doing a degree, even without honours, was a big thing. Then honours was the next thing, and then PhD. Unfortunately, these days, having an undergraduate degree with or without honours, you know, I think the stats are something like 40 to 50% of students when, you know, go on to do some research, to go on to do some tertiary qualification, not necessarily a bachelor's degree. But in Australia, we have a very high level of education. It's great, but it does mean that it's competitive.
Can I add a couple of points here? I agree with everything that Sylvia said. And I think a couple of things to think about too. I mean, I think if you want to run a lab, I think it'd be pretty hard to do that without a PhD, honestly. I mean, maybe Sylvia would disagree.
Oh, no, I agree. It would be very difficult to do that.
But I think, you know, if you're at a position where you're a research assistant and you're not really sure what you want to do, there's nothing wrong with just working for a little while to find what your feet is. And I think it helps build up some extra skills so that when you do get into your PhD, you get into a flying start. Because there's another factor that's important here. If you want to go down and run a lab, there's a lot of early career sort of incentives in the grant scheme and so on, and they all start ticking from the date you complete your PhD. So if you've got a lot of experience before you start your PhD, it can actually give you a real head start later down the track. So that's something to think about. But I wouldn't be too worried about delaying a PhD if you just want to work things out for a time. But I also want to say that doing a PhD is not going to railroad you into a career in science, because I think some people are worried about that. Because I think the skills you learn in a PhD are transferable in many different areas, and it's certainly, especially the communication, the ability to think about problems and problem solve is really a brilliant skill you learn in your PhD.
I'm going to stand a little closer to you when I say this so that they can't hit me, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with enrolling and giving it a crack. I mean, most people have this feeling that once they're in it, they're stuck. I mean, the advice I used to give to my honours students when I was in physics is enrol. If you really hate it after a year, it's not for you, and you will have found that out. It's not the end of the world. We often make our choices by making mistakes, right? And sometimes it's worth actually giving it a go. And I suspect in most people's cases, they will end up enjoying it, but they will have points, highs and lows, that really can be severe. But overall, the experience, if you choose the right supervisor and lab, can be very positive. So my advice is give it a go, enroll. Don't like it, you know, it'll annoy your supervisor, no end, but it's not about them. So worst case scenario I can tell you about there is a PhD student I took on. I took her on because she was about to publish that an atomic force microscope had imaged the double helix of the DNA strand. That was my particular field, atomic force microscopy. I knew that was physically impossible, so I kind of said to her other supervisor, maybe this is not the way to go. She had two supervisors. I came on as a third supervisor. Both of her supervisors in biochemistry died within 2 years. She was at sea completely. It was a very tough time. She finished. She's now working, I think, at the Baker. But she's working in one of our really top-end research institutes, maybe Peter Mac perhaps. But she got through, but it was a difficult time. But there was that option of sort of diverting her work to other areas, but still using many of the skills that she'd sort of gained. So it does happen.
So there are two other things I want to add to that is, one, there is also an option of writing up your thesis for an MPhil, which might be 18 months into your PhD. It does involve writing it up, but it's a smaller, so instead of 80 to 100,000 words, it's about 30,000 words. And that is a valuable qualification to have, so that's always an option if you really decide you can't go on longer. And then my other comment really is about supervisors. So the university is moving more and more towards having a panel of supervisors. I have students, some of whom may have four supervisors. It might seem a bit difficult, and sometimes it's hard to get everyone in the same room at once, but you can choose supervisors who bring different skill sets to your work, and some who you might get on a little bit better with than others. So your choice of supervisors is important, and you absolutely have every right to include as many supervisors as you wish. And in fact, you are no longer allowed to have a single supervisor in the university.
So I just want to get one more question before we close, but then of course you will have the opportunity to talk to them afterwards. Was there one over here? Yeah. So the question is, what is the main drive for you as researchers? Is it something personal or something grander? Danny?
Look, it's difficult. I mean, I love problem solving and getting new knowledge to help benefit people, I guess. I mean, you know, I work on Huntington's disease, but I have to say it's not because I'm passionate about Huntington's disease, but it's because I want to contribute to science. And actually, as I've gone through my PhD, I've found that I've got a particular skill set where I think I can answer questions particularly well, actually, for Huntington's disease. So I've actually made some calculated decisions along the way to apply a lot of my training and my skills to this problem, because I think I can make progress in it by filling in certain niches. It's a little bit complex to explain, but for me, that's what drives me, is that, you know, I want to make a difference. I don't really honestly care what disease it is. I think all diseases are important. But for me, I want to do something where I feel like I'm not hitting my head against a wall. Because, you know, often there's very trendy areas. I think Shane mentioned this earlier, and you might get sort of sucked in because, you know, everyone's talking about stem cells. But, you know, everyone else in the world's also thinking about this now as well. So, you know, sometimes it's better to think maybe in a more targeted approach about where you can apply your skills or where you feel like you can make a difference. And that's certainly been my thinking. I mean, I'm not really swept up in sort of whiz-bang, you know, technologies or whatever. You know, I just do what I think can make a difference.
Brad, what motivates you?
Mostly just the enjoyment, really. I mean, I work on a disease that's fairly rare. I think it kills 1 in a million people. So it's not really, you know, going to make a massive contribution to society if we cure it. But it is a very unique disease in the way it sort of manifests itself and behaves. And it's just something that has a lot of very rare properties, and that's sort of, I find, quite exciting about it. And it's really sort of drives, you know, the research forward. So yeah, pretty much just pure enjoyment of it and the excitement derived from what I actually work on. So,
Look, I've changed fields lots and lots of times in my research, and sometimes one can argue that that's a good thing or a bad thing. So it's good in the sense that I've got a lot of broad-based knowledge, helps with teaching. It's bad, I think, in terms of sometimes your career track, you know, can. But having said that, I think what drives you is that you have a questioning mind. You want to find answers to things. If you're not interested in questions and answers, then why would you do research? Because that's what it's all about.
Karen, you're sort of in a different world now, but you still interact with the research a lot.
That's right.
I mean, what's driving you now? Has it changed significantly from when you were a researcher?
It's a bit broader now. I mean, if you're doing your PhD project or your postdoc, you've got this one project that you're really focused on and you're driven by that. Whereas I now get to see science across the board. I do everything from pharmaceuticals to genes. I see everything. So because of that, everything for me is new. It's pretty rare that I'll actually come across an application that requires my HIV knowledge or my gene therapy knowledge. So it's always new and exciting because you're always learning something new.
And just to add to Karen's comments there, I mean, I've moved out of my research crew as well up into the VC's office, and so I see all of the research as well. And I have to say, for me, and probably similar to you, Karen, that is what's, addressing the curiosity for this stuff in me. And that, and of course, doing the radio program where I hear about it every week from different people, all the new exciting stuff. And it is just, it's mind-boggling just, you know, how much good stuff is going out there. And it's mind-blowing just how many great people we have in Melbourne doing it. But of course, the important point is that we need to keep refreshing that group and getting more people into these areas. And as I said before, medical research is a growth area. And we know that because of our population statistics, because of the prevalence of disease in our society, various other factors. And so it's one where there will be plenty of opportunities for people in the future. I think a couple of key things have come out tonight. One is the element of communication, how important that is for people in these careers. And so don't think of it as sort of just something you can forget about until the end. Try and develop those skills all the way through, even now while you're, some of you are in your undergraduate, develop those skills. It requires you to be able to handle critique from colleagues, which is something that is naturally difficult for most people. So the communication element is a critical factor, and I think even more important for what you're thinking about doing is choosing the right supervisor, the right project, and the right lab. One that isn't necessarily the best, but one that certainly suits you and what you're after. And there's a variety of options there available to you. So make sure you explore them, be savvy about it, be tough, ask the right questions, get people to help you with those questions if need be, if you're unsure, but make the right choice so that if you do go into a PhD, at least you get the best possible experience you could hope for there, and you don't end up leaving it because of one bad supervisor or bad lab or bad team, because many of the people who do it get great satisfaction. So just ask you to join me in thanking our panel tonight, Brad, Danny, Karen and Sylvia, for giving up their time. I'm sure they'll be around for a short time while food is served. I'm going to hand back now to Natalie, who I think has a couple of words, but thanks for coming along.
Thanks very much, Shane. So I hope this has been a very informative evening for you all to help with probably working out what sort of research you'd like to do for a particular project, but maybe on the long term, where you would like your career to, or how you'd like to structure your career and the things that you might need to start thinking about now, the things that you want to do 3 or 5 years down the track. So once again, I'd like us to thank Sylvia, Karen, Danny, Brad and Shane for this wonderful session. And on behalf of ASMR and the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences at Melbourne University, we just want to show a token of our appreciation. So thank you very much. Thank you.